welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news. And, well, just about anything else that might come along from your questions via email or telephone. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, the first thing I want to do is give a shout out to UCSC and specifically to Professor Susan Strome for an excellent talk last night about transmission of developmental instructions, basically really starting to unravel epigenetics and the discovery of some really cool things about how we maintain our germ cell line. I'm very proud to be part of a community that is doing such cutting-edge work. Now, on the negative side, we really, really need to do something about free market capitalism in its current form with medicine. A guy named Martin Shkreli, I think it's probably pronounced Shkreli, is kind of a Wall Street hedge fund predator. He's done some interesting things. He's basically set up websites and posted kind of badly spun and somewhat, unrepresentative and not quite false information about drugs. Drugs that belong to companies that he's selling short, which basically means he's betting the stock is going to go down and he's doing his best to make sure it does. Okay, well, you could say that's fair game in the shark-infested waters of modern capitalism, but I'm not so sure this one is. His latest move is that he has purchased a drug. This drug is trade name is Daraprim. The technical name for it is pyrimethamine. It was invented in 1953, and it's an anti-parasite drug. It's used to treat malaria, and more importantly, it's used to treat toxoplasmosis, which is a parasite that you can get from kitty litter. And it is a parasite that causes some severe birth defects. And so it's critical that we find it and treat it in pregnant women who might acquire it. Well, this drug has been around, as I said, since 1953. Its market price was $13.50 a pill before Martin came along. It's now $750 a pill. And this is creating some substantial problems because private insurers, Medicare, and hospitalized patients are going to have to pay that list price, which is just, well, ridiculous. This is the second antibiotic that I know about that has become extremely expensive all of a sudden because of, well, market manipulation in a barefaced form. We need to write our congresspeople. We need to, I know, but maybe we can get some legislation. Maybe we can push for FDA rule changes. This needs to stop. This is complete and ridiculous profiteering off the backs of sick people. And it's not okay to do this to make money. I'm sorry. Free market it may be, but this is ridiculous. I want to give a shout out to Bruce in Elkhorn for bringing the hedge fund story to my attention, because obviously I led with it. And so credit to Bruce and invitations. If you see an interesting story that you'd like to share with a broader audience, pass it on, because I often take suggestions from the floor, so to speak. So let's change the subject and talk about something interesting scientifically. This paper was published in Medical Acupuncture volume 27, number 4. That is the August 2015 issue. And it is an article looking at treating hypertension with acupuncture. Very simple treatment, electrical acupuncture at pericardium 5 and 6 and stomach 36 and 37. And they treated them once a week for 8 weeks. And measured blood pressure. They saw a statistically significant improvement in blood pressure that was meaningful at the level that you might expect from a drug. They were able to measure changes in the plasma concentration of noradrenaline and plasma renin and plasma aldosterone. So this wasn't just relaxation after acupuncture. You actually shifted kidney physiology, and kidney physiology is what drives hypertension in the first place. So very good proof of concept. One of the groups was followed out an additional 4 weeks, and the decline in blood pressure persisted for at least a month after the treatments stopped. I'm very excited about this, and I intend to be applying their protocol in my own medical practice and seeing if I can get good results. I have a lot of people who are kind of borderline, and I'm working with them on diet and lifestyle. Diet, by the way, is lots of fruits and vegetables and moderate amounts of calcium and magnesium, and those things lower blood pressure, along with 20 to 30 minutes of walking a day. Many people with stage 1 hypertension can go back to being normal with just those simple behavioral modifications. And I don't know about you, but I'd rather change my lifestyle than consign myself to taking a pill every day. But that's not for everybody, so we do need those pharmaceuticals, and we do need them available. Oh, I also wanted to also mention, I do use amino acid therapy, primarily L-arginine, although some of my colleagues also use taurine, and those tend to lower blood pressure as well. And so just remember, if you're going to use amino acid therapy, you probably want to do it in consultation with someone who knows what you're doing, because there can be some untoward side effects. This isn't really something to do just because you read about it in the Reader's Digest, or, for that matter, heard about it on Ask Dr. Don. I'm going to skip to an email now. This is from Mary in Carmel. Mary writes, subject, eating nuts. I too have had problems eating nuts. I've found that if I soak the nuts, it removes a fair amount of the phytic acid, and I can then eat the nuts without problems. And Mary, I'm not really sure that the phytic acid is the thing that's causing your problem. Phytic acid is basically phosphorus and inositol. It's something that is manufactured inside cells by the human body, but it's in the shells of nuts and lots of other grains as well. So whole grains have more phytic acid than refined grains. And the main thing phytic acid does in the gut is it binds minerals. So it doesn't, at least so far as I could find in a quick web search this morning after receiving your email, I did not see any indications that it caused GI upset. So I'm thinking the soaking is probably rendering the nuts just basically more digestible for you, and you might be wrong about it being related to the phytic acid. Let's go now to our first caller, and that's Paige in Carmel Valley. Hello, Paige. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I love your show.
Thank you.
My mom has had colon cancer that metastasized her liver, and she's been having chemotherapy every 2 to 3 weeks. She's on her fifth session. And when's the point when you know you've had enough chemo and you should think about trying something else, because it seems like it's tearing her up too much?
Well, okay, so this is a question that covers both scientific and philosophical topics. And let's start with the scientific piece. You can go to the NIH website, which is NIH.gov, and you can go to the Cancer Institute, and you can look at the statistics for 5-year and 10-year survival with any cancer at any stage. And the reason we do that staging is so we can do statistical analysis, because obviously if I catch a breast cancer while it's microscopic, the chances that it's spread are much lower than if I don't catch that breast cancer until it's eating a hole through the skin of the breast.
Yeah.
And so you can't just say, oh, well, you have breast cancer and how long will you live? Because that lumps the very advanced cancers with the very mild ones. So staging is a very important thing.
Right.
And not all cancers, every cancer is unique in the sense that while they share many common mutations and many common characteristics, they're occurring, first of all, in a unique individual. And secondly, the cancer itself is not homogenous. So within a tumor, you'll have more aggressive and less aggressive ones and things that are more vulnerable to one type of chemotherapy. And as you keep hitting the body with chemotherapy, you're forming selective pressure. So you are killing off the cells that you can kill off and leaving behind the ones that are not vulnerable. And the cells themselves evolve. The cancers evolve to become good at literally vomiting out the, it's called efflux, and they vomit out the chemo agent. So they become resistant and more resistant. And then the strategy, if you're going to keep fighting the cancer, is you switch to a different chemo and then you switch to a different chemo.
Uh-huh.
And many of these drugs, at least, are very toxic and have serious side effects, which are worse when you're old. And people don't have the resiliency when they're older. So we often end up killing them through exhaustion and attrition of the other cells, which take a hit as well. And
we've been doing support with green drink and acupressure and massage and frankincense and really good diet, and she's responded really well to all those things. I mean, you know, she's on, seems to be on the mend, but, you know, she was diagnosed July 4th and she's doing much better, but we're all still pretty scared. I know you understand.
Of course. And this may be, and likely is, but it is still a maybe. This may be her terminal illness. And
yes,
so you look at this as a person who's the person with the cancer.
Yeah.
You kind of look at it and say to yourself, okay, is my life worth it? What am I going to get for the pain I'm going through right now? And if the answer is I'm going to get to see my granddaughter graduate from high school, or I'm going to have a great summer, and you know, then everything may come crashing down. Then it really becomes a value judgment that the individual needs to make. And I think where the family can most assist is to be supportive and to support autonomy and say, Mom, it's your call.
Right.
Whether to continue this. And if you want to continue it, then I am right there with you. But you don't need to feel like you're letting me down if you stop. Because a lot of times the family, in saying, I love you, you know, they also send the signal, please hang around, I can't handle losing you. Which puts the person in a double bind. So
I don't think she's at that point now, because all of her treatments have made her feel better and she has a lot of good days.
Yeah, but so.
But you know, it's up to her. I get it.
It is up to her, and we all own this decision for ourselves. If we can exercise autonomy, it's our last, you know, truly maturing experience, is the ability to exercise adult autonomy at the time of our ending. So I think that there is no right answer to when do you stop. From a medical standpoint, when you can't see any more tumor on CAT scan, when you can't find circulating tumor cells in the bloodstream, tumor markers, exactly. That's when you say, all right, looks like we've got it. Now we're going to monitor. And, you know, if it's metastatic to the liver, I don't know what off the top of my head, I don't know what the odds are, but the websites can tell you with current chemotherapy what the odds are that you were successful.
I guess, you know, like everybody, we're wishing for a magic bullet, mistletoe, or whatever to help us.
You know, it really,
in
my experience, and when I look at those cases where in the natural management of medicine, first of all, I think you need to use, you have to be selective of what chemo you use. But, you know, if I had cancer, I would shift my lifestyle to the extent that I could. But I have a pretty clean lifestyle right now in the first place. So
yeah.
There's not much there's not much room for improvement. If a person's on a standard American diet and they're sedentary and they don't exercise and they drink a couple of drinks a day, that's the person actually who's going to benefit from lifestyle change, because that's the person who's got a pretty messed up milieu, if we could say. The cancer has a chance to really thrive because that's a favorable cancer environment. You know, it's full of free radicals and there's low antioxidants and there's immune suppression. So that's an individual who's got a lot of improvement that maybe that cancer can't survive in a healthy body, but it could survive in an unhealthy body. So if you can make the body healthier, the cancer withers away. And that does happen. And the problem that I've seen is that people who are already in pretty good shape, when they get cancer, that cancer has grown up in a healthy milieu, so you can't fix the milieu that much more. You can do things like boot the immune system with mushrooms, and green drinks are super because they contain lots of materials that have putative anti-cancer properties.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think particularly getting rid of sugar in the diet is good because cancer cells need sugar for metabolism. And I'm very much pushing people in the direction of ketogenic diets if they've got metastatic cancer, if they can stand it. But you have to keep them from losing weight. And if they're on chemo,
that's a concern.
Yeah, you can't really do both a ketogenic diet and chemotherapy together really well because you shrink.
She's already shrunk, so.
Yeah, and so you have to be selective about when you do these things and how you do them.
Right.
But ultimately, I don't believe in miracles in the sense that we're going to use mistletoe or we're going to use some kind of herb as drug intervention that's going to, you know, the heavens will open and the angels will sing.
I'm glad you're balanced in that department.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, I hope that's been a helpful discussion for you. And certainly,
thank
I think
Dr.
probably
Young.
For the rest of the listeners, there are people out there who are really glad you called in with this question.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going now to Gary in Santa Cruz. Hello, Gary, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I've got mistletoe over all my doorways.
Well, I'm sure that gets you lots of stress-reducing kisses.
Lots of kisses. Anyway, I've called you before, and I have so appreciate your professionalism. I did go up. I have, since May, I've had severe sciatica, and lots of fun, lots of ache, lots of pain, lots of pain management with acupuncture. And once or twice a week, I do all kinds of good stuff, exercises. I did go to Stanford, and I got a wonderful orthopedic surgeon to give me we had a good talk. What the plan is now is to do since I have compression fractures on the L4 and L5, I have right L5 nerve root compressed. We're going to do a kyphoplasty because I have I've cracks in a couple of vertebrae. He's going to do an injection of the cement in there, kyphoplasty.
Are they going to do just the cement, or are they also going to do the balloon thing?
Is the balloon thing the micro decompression?
No.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So, I do know what a micro decompression is, and they're basically microsurgical. It's a microsurgical procedure. And they're trying to open up the space where the nerve root comes out. So what is your question? I have the background now.
My question, I'm getting a second opinion from you. So he's going to do the kyphoplasty and the micro decompression on L4 and L5. And I'm just wondering if you think that's a good thing to do to help relieve this wonderful ache and pain that I have.
Do you have any atrophy or loss of muscle size on the side that has the L4 and L5, or sorry, the L4 nerve root compression?
I don't think so, Dr. Don, because I ride my bike a lot, which is comfortable. I lift weights a lot, which is pretty comfortable.
How's the sensation? Is there any nerve? Loss, like numbness on the leg?
There is numbness. Some days there's numbness. But mostly it's just ache across the right glute and down the right thigh and the epicenter below the right knee on the outside. That's where it's like pretty constant.
Okay. So kyphoplasty it has been around for probably about 10 or 15 years. And so the first, and I don't know this, I don't have this in my head, I don't know the complication rate, but I have seen some, I've seen some successes and I've seen some failures, and I don't have a big enough N to, you know, have any sense for what the complication rate is. But before you do a procedure where anything's going to be left in your body that is not a new to nature, that is a new to nature molecule, you want to look at the long term complications and see if anything is showing up in the first cohort. So you could do this with a Google search. If you go to the Google Scholar website, it only gives you articles, scientific articles. It doesn't give you ads. It doesn't give you, you know, Dr. Jones's orthopedic website with education about kyphoplasty. And you can search, you can select for review articles. So that's what I would do. I would, you know, look at complications, kyphoplasty review as a search and see what comes up, see what the statistics tell you. Because when you're doing something, when you operate for pain as opposed to function,
right,
there's always, I'm always skeptical that that's the best thing to do. And that is, that's not that I'm rejecting the idea, because I can't judge your clinical situation without looking at your MRI and and your nerve conduction studies and doing a clinical exam on you. So I can't really give you a fair second opinion. I can give you a general, sort of a general statement that that when your back is against the wall and you've got muscle atrophy, then you absolutely have to act. When you are looking at pain but function is good, then temporizing measures. I don't understand where you got these compression fractures. Was it a trauma? Did you?
Everybody asked me that same question. I have severe osteoporosis. I don't know how I got it. I don't know. I have had a number of bicycle accidents over the years, and I don't know how I got the compression fractures.
Okay. Have you had nerve conduction studies?
Nerve conduction studies? No.
Okay. I would recommend that. So here's a fair statement. If a person has pain, no loss of function beyond some numbness some days, then I would insist on an abnormal nerve conduction study before I encourage them to get an operation, because you can get pain that radiates to the buttock, that is referred pain from the back, that is not nerve root compression. So even if the MRI shows an impinged nerve root, that just shows the potential for nerve compression. Sometimes just, you know, and just the microsurgical procedure, just opening up the foramina in many people with sciatica is adequate. A lot of people also have disc disease. You should also look into a trial of salmon calcitonin, which is a nasal spray. And it is for some reason, and I don't think any of us understand why, it is an anesthetic for compression fractures of the spine. So it's nasal calcitonin. It's called salmon calcitonin, calcitonin, and I do not remember the name of the, you know, the commercial name for the product, but the generic name is salmon calcitonin, and it's a cloned product, and you squirt it in your nose, and it reduces pain from compression fractures. And I would certainly say that it would make sense to try that and subtract the compression fracture pain and see what happens to that buttocks pain, because some of that may be referred pain from the spine and not really going to go away with kyphoplasty.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, lots of people in my acupuncture practice who had back surgery to fix their pain. I have one guy in my practice, not my acupuncture practice, but my regular primary care practice, who had four back surgeries and finally his pain went away. So I don't know what happened with the first three, but the fourth one was the charm for him. But nevertheless, he obviously, the first three were not helpful. So it's, you got to be selective. And obviously surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, want to operate. You know, that's what they do. So he's going to give you his best opinion about surgery. And it sounds like you've tried conservative, but maybe there's a little bit more to try. And certainly I think a nerve conduction study would be a reasonable thing to request.
Okay,
by the way, it's not a walk in a park, the nerve conduction study. They stick needles in you. So it's pokey, but it's not horrible, and you can put up with it, and it's way better than having an unnecessary back surgery.
Yeah, so it's called abnormal nerve conduction studies, and also the other one is called salmon calcitonin.
Salmon like the fish, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, calcitonin, I-N. So,
and that's available by prescription?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, great.
Okay, well, so actually, let's see. We got three drugs. My producer has given me the trade names. Miacalcin is probably the one that's in the United States. Miacalcin.
Miacalcin.
Okay, you're. I'm going to spell it again. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Miacalcin.
Got it.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to take a moment and read you a very interesting science story, and then we'll go back to the phones. And those numbers to call are 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. So, it's like, we called it the genetic code, and we thought when we figured out that there were three codons, and those stood for amino acids, and the ribosomes built the proteins, we thought that was it. We thought we understood it. And then along came epigenetics, turning methylation, histone acetylation. And then we understood that, oh, wait, it's not just that code. You can attach footnotes to the code. And then we learned about micro-interfering RNA and the fact that you could take the code after it had been decoded and stop it from being made. And then out from there came the CRISPR-Cas9. So those of you who have been on this ride with me for the last 6 months will not be surprised to learn that, but wait, there's more. We've always thought that it was kind of odd that amino acids, there's 20 amino acids, and there are about three different codes, set triplet codes in the DNA for each amino acid. And a lot of times it's the last codon that is different. So maybe it's a G instead of a T, but it doesn't matter because you still get a lysine. And we thought, well, that's redundancy and it doesn't mean anything. Well, of course it means something. And in fact, that third codon in the genetic code, that third nucleotide is actually going to make a difference in protein folding. It works like this. The speed that the RNA is turned into a protein is faster or slower depending upon the codon that's coding for the protein. So the most common one is the fastest one. If you have one of the less common codons, you still get the same amino acid, but because that amino acid, because the half-formed protein is hanging out there in the cytoplasm for longer before that next charged particle, that next charged amino acid is attached, it actually folds, curls up on itself differently. And so the protein coils up differently depending on the speed that it is spat out of the ribosome. And this third codon is thus influential in how well a particular protein is going to work. And thus, this is subject to natural selection. Let me give you an example. Suppose that there is a substance in the environment that is toxic. It just happens to be, let's say, a lot of arsenic in the water. And arsenic, of course, poisons us by interfering with enzymes. It gets into the place where we should have something like a copper or a zinc and replaces the copper and the zinc. And then the enzyme can't work. And if your enzymes don't work, you die. Well, let's suppose that there's a lot of arsenic around. And so the normally folded enzyme, the one with the most common codon, is subject to infiltration and deactivation by arsenic. But the one that folds a little bit differently, maybe it's not as efficient a version of this enzyme, so it isn't favored in evolution, but it's still there, hanging out, waiting to be needed. And lo and behold, in a high arsenic environment, this differently folded enzyme is resistant to infiltration by arsenic, and therefore the enzyme function survives and the individual is effectively arsenic resistant. So yet another level of biological adaptability that we are finding over and over again embedded in this same genetic code, the same gene sequence. And we're now finding that there's also frame shift. So it may be that there are more genes in there than we even realize, but that some of them are overwritten on other genes, and that there are signals that say, no, jump one to the right and then start transcribing. And of course, that changes everything. So exciting to be working in biology and DNA right now. We have these wonderful tools, and it's a discovery a minute. It's awesome. Let's go to Robin in Santa Cruz. Hello, Robin, and welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Robin.
Hi.
And my question is, I was diagnosed with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, shown by a hydrogen breath test, and it was suggested that I take either Flagyl or Rifaximum, and I'm wondering which is the better antibiotic for this diagnosis in terms of side effects, in terms of dealing with the offending bacteria, and in terms of the possibility of relapse.
Relapse is a big problem with antibiotic therapy. Do we have any SIBO, by the way, for the audience, is small intestine bacterial overgrowth. And the way I like to explain it to patients is that if you were to take a cubic centimeter, you know, a cc of stomach contents, and you were to do a bacterial count, you might find 10 or 15 bacteria. That's because of the acid in the stomach. If you move to the small intestine in that same cc, you might find, let's call it 1,000 to 10,000 bacteria, which is less than what you've got on your skin. So still fairly clean. If you go down into the colon, on the other hand, it's millions of bacteria per cc. And so orders and orders of magnitude more. And that's how it's supposed to look. When you have SIBO, instead of having 10,000 bacteria per cc in your small intestine, you've got 10 million or a million. And they're not supposed to be there, and they compete with your own body for the food. So they make gas, and people get horrible bloating quickly after eating. Basically, as soon as their stomach empties, they start getting bloating. Some people as soon as 5 minutes after they eat. And there's a reason you have this. And that's the problem. That's the disconnect with SIBO right now in medicine is, again, we're treating it as if it were an infection. And it's not an infection. Yeah. You know, it's when you've got mold growing on the walls in your house, it's not the mold, because the mold spores are everywhere. It's the house. Mm-hmm. It's the moisture. And it's created an environment where the bacteria can live. Yeah, so just killing the bacteria, that's great. That's like throwing bleach on the wall. But once the bleach dries off and a month later, you're going to have mold again. So you're going to have SIBO again unless the cause can be identified. And often it can't be. You can't figure out why does this person have SIBO, and you end up doing things to, you know, try to mitigate what it, you know, what your guess is at the cause. Sometimes there's a history of surgery, or there's fistulas, or the person's had a gastric bypass. So of course you know why they've got SIBO, and you also know you're, because it's structural, you're not going to be able to fix that one, and what you're going to do is suppress it. And then you have to have long-term suppressive therapy. Getting back to your first question, Flagyl, which is metronidazole, versus rifaximin, which is Xifaxan, I think is the trade name for that. Mm-hmm. Well, one of them's really cheap and one of them's really expensive. So the first consideration is that one. Metronidazole, it probably has a lot more side effects in terms of systemic side effects. You can't mix it with alcohol, for one thing. And even if a little bit of alcohol, like Coq au Vin or something, will get you, because it's like disulfiram. It basically doesn't let you process the aldehydes. Your liver turns the alcohol into aldehyde, and the aldehyde's really toxic, as in formaldehyde. But you can't process it away, so you vomit like crazy. So you need to be aware of that piece. But a lot of people get kind of a head buzz and fatigue and nausea from Flagyl, and most people tolerate the rifaximin fairly well because it's not absorbed in people with an intact gut. I have my doubts about it, whether it's non-absorbed in people who have a leaky gut, but that's a different conversation. I guess it depends on the level of permeability defect. But in general, is there any sense for why you in particular have SIBO?
Well, I do. I discovered that I have low vitamin D3.
That
I have a number 23.
Yeah, that's not it.
Okay.
That's not
Even
it.
Even though vitamin D does have to do with gut health.
Oh, yes, but that's not why you have...
I have no idea. It's okay. Just been coming on slowly, this kind of burning sensation in my gut and some painful bloating. I mostly feel it at night when I wake up in the middle of the night. I just feel like, ah, God, there's a blowtorch going on in there. And it's not in my esophagus at all. It's all below my rib cage and above my belly button.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well... Have you had an endoscopy?
Yes, that was clear. So was the colonoscopy.
Okay. Did you ever have diverticulitis?
No.
Okay. Okay. So we don't. What about abdominal surgery?
No.
Okay. So we don't really have any. So it's a functional issue, and one of the tricks for long-term benefit, you should go, there's some good SIBO websites up there.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I learned from one of the websites, and I'm sorry, offhand, I don't remember whose website it was, mm-hmm. was using erythromycin at night, particularly in people who do the night bloat. The erythromycin actually stimulates a very strong peristaltic wave. And physiologically at night when you're asleep, there's this big... kind of sweep of peristalsis, these big heavy-duty waves that kind of wash out the bacteria that's trying to climb up into the small intestine. So like wringing out a washcloth. And so the gut really wrings itself out, and sometimes that functionality is lost for whatever reason.
That's what's referred to as mobility?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
so that's one of the things that, you know, if you could obviously make sense. If the river is running rapidly in one direction, swimming upstream is hard. If the river is stagnant, swimming upstream is easy. And effectively, the colon bacteria are swimming upstream.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can increase the downward flow,
yes.
then you wash them back down where they belong. And they're just looking for territory, right? They're programmed to grow and thrive and eat. So they're just following their genetic programming. So using the erythromycin at night for you might be one of the benefits. The other thing I've seen lately that worries me is I've seen people with SIBO taking high dose probiotics, and I think that could be potentially very counterproductive. And I honestly don't know what dose of probiotics to give someone while I'm trying to treat their SIBO. So since I don't know that, I tend to give fairly low doses.
Okay.
You know, like in the not in the 100, 200 billion range that I see people, I see some people doing that, and I don't think it's quite right.
Okay.
So stay tuned.
Can this be treated without antibiotics by diet and herbs alone?
Yeah, and sometimes that can be successful, but it's hard.
Okay.
And so you essentially have to go no starch whatsoever. And pretty high doses of things like oregano oil and Pau d'Arco and Uva Ursi. I have a couple of people with fistulas where bits of the intestine are actually connected to each other by little bridges that have formed. And in this case, this is an incurable SIBO because the bacteria don't have to swim upstream. They can take the shortcut. And I keep an individual on this particular individual on suppressive doses of antibacterial herbs, and then we just change him. Every 4 to 6 weeks, I figure, okay, we've had time to develop resistance, and we move to a different agent, and then we move to a different agent, and that's at least keeping the symptoms at bay.
Okay.
And you know, sometimes it's chronic disease.
Thank you very much for your help today.
You're very welcome. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Another science story before we go back to the phones. And this about a breakthrough in, would you believe? Hey, it's got to be Ask Dr. John Saturday because we've talked about the microbiome and we're about to talk about stem cells. So, and epigenetics, we already covered that one. They were here all the time. Pancreatic stem cells have been located in adult pancreas, and it looks like it's mainly, when it comes to stem cells, it's mainly about figuring out what surface marker to search for, because all cells have these barcodes, these surface markers, and the surface tissue markers the surface tissue marker that they're homing in on for pancreatic stem cells is neurogenin 3, and there are on the exocrine pancreas, this is the part that makes the digestive enzymes. There are cells that make neurogenin 3. You can take these cells and basically turn them into pancreatic beta cells. Those are the cells that make insulin. So you can create from an individual's own tissue and potentially also from cadaver tissue, which is important. You can create a stem cell implant of beta cells that could then be put in the pancreas of people with type 1 diabetes and potentially be curative. And this would also work for people with diabetes due to recurrent pancreatic infections. So stay tuned for more information, but it looks to me like the stall that we've had with pancreatic transplants, which is that we have tissue rejection issues that make it not worth doing. If we can biopsy the pancreas and grow up pancreatic cells from the individual's own body with their own surface markers and then implant them back into the pancreas, or maybe not even into the pancreas, but into a different tissue in the gut, we may be able to take people who are very insulin dependent and make them less insulin dependent or maybe even independent of insulin. It's at least possible. Our next caller is Annette in Berkeley. Hello, Annette. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about depression. I have been, over the last 2 years, making a lot of improvement in terms of becoming a lot more active and exercising regularly and stuff like that. But my remaining problem is that I think underneath the depression, I have some anxiety, and I wake up at 3 every night, and then I can't sleep anymore. And I wondered, I don't want to take antidepressants, and I want to figure out, is there anything else I can do?
Well, first of all, how old are you? And are you postmenopausal?
I'm in my 50s.
Are you postmenopausal?
Yes.
Because that 3 a.m. wake up is a very, very common complaint, not just in depression.
But I've always pretty much had it even before that.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and but it gets worse at menopause. So you asked, what are some of the options? You could do a trial of bioidentical hormones, and particularly progesterone, taken at bedtime orally, can be very, very helpful with sleep in postmenopausal women. So that might be something to look at. The second thing, and this is kind of coming out of Chinese medicine, is no alcohol, no caffeine. If you haven't already done that, you need to do that. Because this, as I said, this comes from a Chinese medical concept called the harari or body clock. And it is at 3 in the morning when the liver hands the energy to the lung. And if the liver has too much energy, when it hits the lung, it wakes you up. I mean, that's a very poetic sounding description. And physiologically, I'm sure that there's something that we would describe very differently in medicine. But it's a phenomenon. It's a thing, this 3 a.m. wake up. And when you shift time zones, it follows you to 3 a.m., which is really strange when you stop and think about that. So losing caffeine, losing alcohol, maybe acupuncture. Sometimes you can reset the body clock with acupuncture if these other methods aren't successful. That's always worth a try. I like sublingual melatonin for wake-ups. And what do you do when you wake up? You say you wake up and you can't get back to sleep, but what are you doing to try to get back to sleep? Or are you not? Are you reading or something like that?
That's what I'm usually doing where I get up, and because I don't want to stay in bed.
Why not?
Well, because I really can't sleep.
Well, okay. Did you know that when you're lying in bed with your eyes closed and your mind relaxed, that you're actually getting some benefit, probably about 50% of the benefit of sleeping, as far as your muscles and your digestive system are concerned? So once you get up and you turn on the light, you automatically drop the output of melatonin. And melatonin is a very short-lived molecule. It doesn't last in the bloodstream very long. So when we're asleep, our pancreas, it's like the drip system in my garden. The pineal gland is dripping melatonin into the bloodstream. It's giving fairly high levels to keep you asleep. Those levels tend to peak at about 2 or 3 in the morning, because that's when this wake-up, when the body has to kind of overcome this wake-up phenomenon. And so if you use sublingual melatonin at that moment when you wake up, keep the lights off and maybe plug in. It's boring to just lie there in the dark, so put on some headphones and listen to a relaxation music or a guided visualization. There's a place called the meditationpodcast.org. You can download one of their podcasts. You can do breathing, like slow rhythmic breathing. Dr. Andy Weil promotes this 8-7-4 breathing, where you breathe in for a count of 8 and hold for the count of 7 and breathe out for the count of 4. And don't let your thoughts think about work, family, the tasks you have to do in the morning. And if you really can't get rid of the task any other way, then take a pen and a piece of paper, have a notebook by the bed, and without turning on the lights, just write on the notebook what it is that you're thinking about, and then put the notebook down and go back to the breathing or go back to the meditation podcast. And more than likely, the combination of the melatonin under your tongue and the not turning the light on and these displacement activities that I've described will let you get back to sleep. It may be an effort, like swimming to the bottom of swimming and touching the bottom of the deep end of the swimming pool, but it is an achievable thing. And so those are the recommendations I would make for you to try at this point. The progesterone, of course, you need to work with someone who knows how to do bioidenticals. But even if you're not taking estrogen, you can take progesterone safely, and it does really help with sleep.
Great. Thank you very much.
Good luck, and let us know how it comes out. Let's go now to Lee in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lee. You have something to say to the 3 a.m. wake up.
Oh, I do. I do this occasionally, sometimes more than occasionally. And what I usually do is I just roll over to a different position in the bed and keep my eyes closed and say over and over again, this is what it looks like when I'm sleeping. And the next thing I know, the alarm goes off, and I was sleeping.
Wow. Okay. It sounds like a kind of homegrown self-hypnosis, and I think it's a great suggestion.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you don't sleep, as you were saying, with your eyes closed, you're part of the way there, maybe not halfway there.
It is true, and I think this is one of the things that the sleep experts say, you know, don't toss and turn, so get out of bed. And I'm like, yes, don't toss and turn, but and don't fret, because the minute you start fretting, you're lost. But getting out of bed, I think, might not be the best advice, and I've certainly don't find it helpful for myself at 3 in the morning when I wake up. That's definitely not the strategy.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. And this is a really interesting story about autism. And ironically, since we were talking about phytate earlier, this is inositol. Remember I said that phytate is made inside your cells? Well, inositol is also made inside your cells. It's made from glucose, and it's a sugar alcohol. And there's a... there's a thing called inositol triphosphate, which is involved in calcium signaling. Calcium is really important for nerve cells. And so when a nerve cell fires, calcium moves out and then moves back in to that cell. And if that doesn't happen at exactly the right speed and with exactly the right threshold, then you're going to end up with a mangled neurological signal, and that's pretty much what we have in autism. So researchers at the University of Irvine believe that they have identified a reliable biomarker for at least certain forms of autism. They looked at 3 different types of autism in this study, the Fragile X and tuberous sclerosis type 1 and 2, and these are 3 different genetic types of autism. There's lots of genetic types of autism. They may have found the Rosetta Stone here, and it's preliminary and it needs to be replicated, but they found a receptor, which is called IP3R, that is located inside the cells, and it is really critical to controlling the release of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum. And this channel is really important for the normal functioning of neurons, and this may be the hinge point where we understand that all of these different genetic defects that we've identified as associated with autism sum up different ways in different individuals, but sum up to a problem with calcium signaling. And having identified a particular receptor that's abnormal, it may be possible to calm down the hyperexcitability of autism in a way that would allow for more orderly thought processes. And this could really be a game changer in the way that anti-epilepsy drugs are a game changer for epileptics. An agent that modulates the IP3R receptor could, in fact, be a major breakthrough. So it's still preliminary, but we've been studying this, racking our brains, trying to understand it, and we've finally gotten somewhere that looks really promising. And let's go to Jane in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jane. We have just a couple minutes.
Yes, very quickly. I too have been having sleeping problems and decided to start taking melatonin, and someone had left some here, and I took it, and it seemed to work, so I bought a bottle. And then I went to look up and read about melatonin, and I realized that what I had bought was 5 milligrams or 0.5, whichever it is, rather than the 3. And I'm wondering if it's safe to go ahead and keep using that, or if going beyond the normal dose is not a good idea.
Well, melatonin's a hormone, and hormones have really interesting properties. So let me just say that there's a whole bunch of people out there who take 20 milligrams of melatonin a day because at that dose it has some anti-cancer properties. And there's small studies that, you know, are debatable, but nevertheless, it's harmless. And interestingly enough, they don't stay awake all night. It doesn't interfere with their melatonin. They don't seem to have it. There's no reported problems with it. Let's put it that way. And on the other spectrum, on the other end of the spectrum, I've had a number of people at lectures that I've attended for at the Institute of Functional Medicine say that there's diminishing returns as you go up on the dose as far as sleep. And so sometimes if a person's taking 3 milligrams and they're not sleeping, rather than give them 6 milligrams, I'll have them cut their 3 milligram in half and it'll work. So sometimes a lower dose works better than a higher dose. So the 3 milligram dose is kind of, call it the average person, the middle of the bell curve. Some people do better with half a milligram. And a lot of times if you take a lower dose of melatonin, but you take it a little earlier, maybe a couple hours before you want to go to sleep, sometimes that makes it work better. So you need to play around with it. So it's not bad to take 0.5, and it's not bad to take 5. But if you're not getting results at that dose, then, double it or cut it in half, effectively. If it's a low dose, double it. If it's a high dose, cut it in half.
Well, actually, it seems to be working for me at this point, and I think, and at least I'm not having quite the same sleeping problems, but I was concerned about side effects, because a little bit that I went to Google Scholar, and, they seemed to be saying something about side effects, and I thought I would, that's why I wanted to ask if I'd like to use this up.
Yeah, what side effects did you read about on Google Scholar?
I'm sorry that I don't remember. It was now a couple of weeks ago.
Because I don't think there's many side effects. So clinically, I think you're fine.
Use it. That was my concern.
It is totally safe to use it.
Maybe going to make my own melatonin production.
Yeah. If you want to make more melatonin, get up in the morning early, get up at the same time every day, and get sunlight in your eyes in the first half hour. If you can get 15 minutes of sunlight in your face right after you wake up, sit and have your tea or something by the window. But that will, 16 hours later, it will reliably trigger a spike in melatonin.
Okay.
So that's how you adjust your body clock. That's what melatonin is.
Well, thank you. I will use it up then, and also have a good excuse to sit out on the deck and enjoy the sun when it's there. Now, what if it's a foggy day?
It's still a good idea.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks.
Bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope you'll be back next week for more Ask Dr. Dawn. You can always listen to the program online at either KUSP.org or AskDrDawn.com. And at the AskDrDawn.com website, there are archives, and we've broken it up into topics. So check it out. So long, and stay healthy.